Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome, and thanks very much for joining me today for a really funny and really fun book to read. So I just finished talking with Xu Bijing about her new translation of Feng Menglong's Treasury of Laughs. It's called Feng Menglong's Treasury of Laughs, a 17th century anthology of traditional Chinese humor. This came out with Brill in 2015. Now, what you'll find in the interview to come is a conversation not only about this really fascinating book, but also about the place of this book, this particular Treasury of Laughs, within a history and larger context of China, of Chinese studies, of humor, both within China and beyond, and also some reflections on how this particular kind of work, a joke book, basically, right, a book of humor from the 17th century, poses opportunities and challenges for a translator. Now, not only are you going to hear Bijing talk about all this, but stay tuned because by the middle to the end of the interview, you'll also hear her very generously sharing some of the jokes with us. I think she reads about 7 jokes from the book, and toward the end, they become sex jokes. So stay for the translation, stay for the theoretization of humor and Ming China, but also stay for the sex jokes at the end. Trust me, they're worth it. And with that, I will leave you to it. Thanks as ever for your support of the channel, for listening, and I hope you enjoy, the joke book in particular as much as I did. I'm here today with Xu Bijing to talk about her new book, Feng Menglong's Treasury of Laughs, a 17th century anthology of traditional Chinese humor. Bijing, thank you so much for being with me today. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. And thanks for both making the time and also giving us such a fascinating and really, really fun translated book to talk about. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So let's talk about what we tend to talk about as the first thing in the channel traditionally. So let's start big. Can you talk a little bit for us about how you came to work on China and the academic study of China specifically? What brought you to the field?
Okay, when I was in Taiwan, my undergraduate degree is foreign languages and literature. So I really never thought that I would make the study of Chinese history my career. And when I came to the United States for graduate study, my first major was comparative literature. I thought that since I have been pretty familiar with the Chinese literary tradition, and also my degree was in foreign languages and literature, I could do a comparison. But when I came to this country, I realized that my department defined comparative literature as a comparison of two different European traditions, and that was not what I was interested in doing. So I transferred to East Asian Studies, and then gradually my interest turned to history. And I thought that China would be a very good field for me to study, because when I was growing up in a Chinese society, I felt that I knew everything about China. So China did not particularly interest me. But after I left a Chinese society and came to an American environment, I found that when I studied history and when scholars mentioned China, they seemed to inspire me to look at China differently. And that got me really interested in the study of China, because I felt that when you step away from China, you probably can see China more clearly than when you are inside of a Chinese environment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. So the book that we're talking about today is a translation of this Feng Menglong work, The Treasury of Laughs. Right. So can you talk for us a little bit about how you came to be interested in this particular work? Maybe why Feng Menglong and why this particular Treasury of Laughs as the focus of your work here?
Yes, I first encountered Feng Menglong's Treasury of Laughs when I was conducting my dissertation in the library. My dissertation title is Celebrating the Emotional Self, Fengmenglong and Lei Ming, Ethics and Aesthetics. And because the University of Minnesota doesn't have a very good East Asian library, I mean, the collection is good, but not very substantial. So I decided to go to Harvard Yenching Library to do my research. Fengmenglong interests me because he is somebody who talks about Qingjiao, emotion-driven romanticism or heroism or, you know, activism. So Fengmenglong says that he defined human life by emotion. Mm-hmm. He said people who don't have emotions, he doesn't think of them as real human beings. And that really touches me because I'm a pretty emotional person, and I always feel like if somebody is always very serious or indifferent and doesn't have a lot of compassion or love or strong feelings, mm-hmm. then it's difficult for me to associate with that person. So I think his Qingjiao, emotion-driven teaching, touches me. And I wanted to read everything Fengmenglong wrote, but particularly the part of his writings that touches on selfhood and emotions. Mm-hmm. So when I decided to go to Harvard Yenching Library, I contacted a friend there whose name is Peter. Peter and I went to the University of Minnesota to do our master's together. And he and I also both work for Professor Ann Wattner. We are her research assistants. I stayed in the University of Minnesota to do my PhD, and Peter went to Harvard to do his PhD. And when he learned that I was going to his school to do my dissertation research, he said that he would be there to give me moral support. So the first book that I picked up at Harvard Yenching Library was Fengmenglong's Treasury of Laughs. Mm-hmm. And Peter sat across the table with me. And when he noticed that I was making great efforts to suppress my giggles, he was very curious. And he asked, what is it that you are reading? And I said, I'm reading a jest book. And he said, I thought you came here to do your dissertation research. He was very angry that I was reading something fun. And then I said, search. And then he said, are you serious? How did you get in to approve of such a project? And you even got a dissertation fellowship to do it. And he became very envious and said, oh, yes, Peter, don't you regret that you leave Minnesota? But I felt that I was sort of taking some sort of risk when I choose sort of a soft topic for my dissertation, because as a historian, people usually anticipate you to do research on an important person or important historical event, important institutions, etc. And so when I chose love songs, you know, short stories and jokes as the primary sources for my research, I knew that some people might thought that those were not very serious source materials. And indeed, when I went on a job search, sometimes people ask me, you are a historian, how can you justify yourself?
Don't you love those kinds of questions? If anyone's listening, please don't ever ask people those kinds of questions in job searches, because they're really not very useful questions. Right. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. But, you know, then when I was doing my first book, my other PhD advisor, Professor Ted Farmer, suggested me that my dissertation is about humor, and not just humor. My dissertation is about emotions and personhood, and then the dichotomy between didacticism and romanticism. But he says that a lot of the materials in my dissertation, he said, he has to admit, is dry. And so he said, when you are turning your dissertation into a big book, please get rid of the dry stuff and just focus on the fun stuff. And so he actually suggested that I wrote a book about humor. And so my first book was entitled Beyond Eroticism, A Historian's Reading of Humor.
Nice.
In Feng Menglong's Child's Folly. Because a lot of people who know Feng Menglong thought that, oh, Feng Menglong is the person who wrote love stories and love songs. And so people associated Feng Menglong with eroticism, you know, something off color. But I feel that it's sort of doing him a lot of injustice because he is also a serious person, but he's a serious person who wants to express his serious ideas in a humorous way. And so I feel that when you look at him simply as somebody who wrote pornographic stories or who have, you know, jokes about sex, that's really just a part of him. But another part of him is he loves to talk about social satire and political criticisms. And even when he wrote love stories, he actually has a lot of moral lessons. For example, he wants lovers to be responsible for their action. He doesn't want people to be lacking in faith. He wanted people to, you know, love somebody and truly love that person with the full heart. And so I think even when we are looking at his love songs and jokes about sex, etc., it's not purely for eroticism. There is a kind of serious undertone, but expressed in a very humorous, you know, lighthearted way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that's great. But also, you know, we're not knocking eroticism and pornography and love songs because those are good too.
Right.
So it sounds like Feng Menglong has just got it all. And you've sort of, you've hit on a really fascinating set of issues here. Uh-huh. Okay. So we're talking about the jokes, right? We're talking about the joke book and this translation that you that we're talking about today and that you've done here for Brill is part of Brill's series on emotions and states of mind in East Asia. Now, early in the book, you talk about being asked to do this translation for the series. So can you talk a little bit for us about how that happened? How did you come to do this particular translation for this particular series?
Okay. It still all goes back to my dissertation. A little more than 10 years ago, once I received an email from Professor Paolo Santangelo, and Paolo Santangelo sent me an email saying that he had read my dissertation and was impressed by it. And he said that he has been doing a lot of research on emotions and states of mind. And he wondered if I could contribute to the field that he has been interested in. And I think at that moment, I just published my Beyond Eroticism, A Historian's Reading of Humor in Feng Menglong's Child's Folly. So I told him about that book, and he immediately said, oh, send me a copy, and I'm going to write a book review for you.
Oh, wow.
And it was wonderful because that was actually the only book review that anybody has read of that book. And he sort of wrote a very long and quite positive review of that book. And then he also asked me if I had other articles that I would like to contribute to his journal that he has been editing, which is called Ming Qing Yanjiu, the research of Ming and Qing dynasties. And I said, I have been interested in dreams, and I had actually done a seminar paper on the universe of dreams in Feng Menglong's Sanyin. But that was sort of an immature essay, and I would like to revise it. And so he said, fine. So I revised it, and I sent it to Ming Qing Yanjiu, and it's about dreams in formal society and how dreams are not just illusions and not just something that is separate from reality, but sometimes the dreams reflected some sort of reality and dreams can even alter reality. And then later he asked me if I could contribute a chapter to a book that he has been editing. Let me check the title of that book, Laughing in Chinese. Mm-hmm. And so I said that I could assemble a few jokes and also doing an analysis of how the jokes reflected self and society. And so I contributed an essay to that volume, but that volume unfortunately, took a very long time to come out. He had difficulty finding a publisher interested in it, but finally it came out. And then he asked me, now this time he says, I have been editing this Emotions and State of Mind in East Asia series for Braille. Would you be interested in doing a complete translation of Fomalhaut's Treasury of Laughs? And I said, I think it would be difficult because when I do a complete translation, I cannot pick things that I find interesting and I cannot pick things that I understand. Because even if a joke is difficult to understand or not funny, I still have to translate it. And so I thought it would be difficult. But he says, you know, it will be a great contribution to this series. And I'll read to you what he put in the preface about sort of the reason why he edited this series. He says, the Emotions and State of Mind in East Asia series concerns the research and analysis of the representation of emotions and states of mind and their collective imagery in East Asia. In this perspective, this new series has opened the way to international publications concerning the topic of the research project that I, meaning Santangelo, started at the end of the 80s. The aim of the series is to gradually build a picture of the mental structures in Chinese history. All the volumes analyze instances of affective experiences over a wide variety of Chinese texts, either presenting the translation of significant sources and or glossaries from the underlying new and the representation of the mental structure in Chinese and other East Asian societies from the angles of cultural anthropology, linguistics, psycholinguistics, literary criticism, history, and sociology. And I know that usually when he published a volume in the Emotions and State of Mind in East Asia series, he would do a glossary of the vocabularies that express certain human emotions. But we agree that we are not going to do a glossary of that kind because the Treasury of Laughs really doesn't have vocabularies that expresses human emotions, because every time when somebody says something, Fomalhaut simply says somebody, which means says. And there are very few words that really talk about emotions. Sort of the emotions of the buffoons can be sensed by the reader, but it's not expressed in words. And so there really isn't a very rich vocabulary that expresses human emotions. It's just that you can sense that this person goes through a lot of different emotions, and then we find his emotional responses quite funny. But the language itself doesn't seem to be funny that way. And so there isn't a glossary. And so he says, because we are not going to be able to create a glossary of the vocabularies of emotions and state of mind, then you would have to write an introduction sort of linking the Treasury of Laughs to emotions and state of mind. So you have to explain why humor is an emotion, or is not an emotion, and how humor carries something important that makes us understand the Chinese mental structure better. And so I did an introduction, and this introduction was done in Taiwan when I was on my sabbatical leave. That's the tail end of my research. I have finished the draft of the entire translation, but because my university is sort of teaching-oriented university, we have very heavy teaching load, and we don't really have a lot of time to do research. And because I was already a full professor, they felt that teaching relief, if they have money for teaching relief, they would give it to junior faculties. And so when I was doing this translation, I had to do it totally out of my own free time. But finally, I weathered through the 7 years of waiting, and I was up for a sabbatical. Mm-hmm. And then I also applied for a Taiwan fellowship to do research in Taiwan, because I felt that I should go to Taiwan to sort of get access to the literature in Chinese, so that I can complement my English literature, English language secondary sources with Chinese language secondary sources. So I was fortunate to be able to get both the sabbatical and the Taiwan fellowship to do the research. And so when I went to the Central Library to double check my translation, because there are a lot of places where I feel a little bit uncomfortable or uncertain, and I have to check a lot of the dictionaries and literary allusions, I have to double check a lot of things. And I realized that I made tons of mistakes, and that was just shocking. I thought that I was pretty good with classical Chinese. But when I checked the dictionaries, and then when I checked the, encyclopedias, I found that there were a lot of things that I misunderstood. And so I felt very lucky that I was able to go to Taiwan to sort of correct a lot of the mistakes.
Great. So let's get right into the book itself to give listeners a sense of some of the richness of the text. So the Treasury of Laughs was compiled by Feng Menglong in the 1610s. It includes more than 700 humorous skits and jokes from both elite sources and from popular sources. Yeah. And Feng Menglong actually rewrote some of them to give the volume a kind of aesthetic and stylistic coherence.
Right.
So let's talk about this work in terms of its significance for a couple of fields. So can you talk for us a little bit about what you take to be the significance of this text for the study of China? How is this text important for how we understand China and for Chinese studies?
Okay. Feng Menglong's Treasury of Jokes include more than 700 jokes, and the source materials really ranged over several centuries. So in a way, we can say that the Treasury of not joke book, it is a synthesis of traditional Chinese humor up to the time of Feng Menglong. And after Feng Menglong published the Treasury of Laughs, this book also becomes sort of a foundation for later joke book authors to use. And so it's a synthesis of almost like the entirety of Chinese humor in various categories. And his materials are very inclusive. For example, he has jokes about old people, and he also have jokes about young people. He have jokes about parents, but he also have jokes about children. He has jokes about the lower class. He have jokes about the upper class. It seems that he is trying to just knock it all out. He doesn't leave any materials out of the collection. He wanted to collect any kind of joke materials that China ever produced. So I think, a way it helps us understand sort of the Chinese mentality and the Chinese humorous tradition very well. And also he is a pretty good editor because he apparently consulted a lot of joke books, but he would leave out jokes that seems to be highly, highly elitist that very few people can understand. And he also left out jokes that are so profane that it really was offensive to the majority of people's sensibilities. And so he already did some sort of gleaning through the materials and chose the materials that are quote-unquote appropriate. But it's appropriate probably for the Ming audience more than for a 21st century American audience, because there are still jokes that seems to be a bit too much, especially the jokes about homosexuals who have anal sex, and there's a lot of, you know, fetus and those kind of things. It's very filthy, but even though some of the jokes seems to be a bit hard to accept from a modern point of view, I think they are still important because they help us understand that political correctness seems to be defined differently in different culture and in different time. And so things that we find very politically incorrect might be politically correct to the Ming audience. That's why those jokes were included in the Treasury of Laughs. So I think it helps us understand the degree of tolerance of the sort of Chinese sensitivity.
Great.
To understand Chinese culture.
Great. Thank you. So you've also talked a little bit about the significance of the text for the study, not just of China, but also for the study of humor specifically. Mm-hmm. So you've already talked a little bit about that, right? Is there anything kind of in general that you'd want to mention in terms of what you take to be, in addition to what you've already mentioned, the significance of this text for the way we understand the study of humor?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that the joke book includes jokes that are, you know, more specifically interesting to the Chinese audience, but it also includes a lot of more universal jokes. For example, anti-establishment jokes and sex jokes and jokes about the relations between the teacher and the students, the relations between, say, the boss and the workers. Even though the specific circumstances differ, still you can make associations and feel that, oh, I can relate to that. And so, for example, a lot of jokes about education, I think it is pretty universal and it can really bring a laugh to pretty much everybody who has been in an educational institution. For example, there is a joke about the exam. It's in chapter 1-4b of Treasury of Laughs.
Did you want to just kind of look at that now? Read that for us now.
Page 44 of
okay.
Page 44 exam 1.4b. A student of the Directorate of Education, sometimes translated as the Imperial University. So a student of the Directorate of Education passes by the door of the academy and hears that the professor is punishing two students who have enraged him with a serious offense. Curious, he asks the doorman if the punishment is a fine, a beating, or a confinement, and learns that the professor is giving the student an essay exam. The student says indignantly, whatever they've done, they don't deserve such an excessive punishment. And I'm sure some of my students would say the same thing because my essay exams are difficult, and they would say, oh, this is a punishment.
I love that. I'm going to use that, but I'm probably actually not going to show my students.
but I think sort of it probably is a joke that would entertain the professors more than the student. Mm-hmm. But there is yet another, if you can indulge me,
yes.
There's yet another story about teacher and student relations that's on page 71.
Mm-hmm.
2.11a, and the title is Sleeping During the Daytime. A teacher dozes off during class hours in broad daylight. When he wakes up, he makes up a story. I was dreaming of the Duke of Zhou, like Confucius. The next day, the student also dozes off during class. The teacher with a refuel, a furrower, and scolds him. How could you fall asleep? The student says, I too was dreaming of the Duke of Zhou. The teacher challenges him. Oh, really? What did the Duke of Zhou say? Well, he said he did not see you yesterday, answers the student. So the joke is both about the student and about the teacher who, you know, dozed off during different times in the class. And I think this this joke is important because sometimes my students do doze off during my lecture and I always got very angry. And I thought, oh, maybe I should remind myself of this joke and then I would not be so angry.
That's right. Well, that's great. Thank you so much. And that's great because also I think it gives listeners a sense of two of the many, 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 many really great jokes. You know, this is a really fun and funny book to read. So in the introduction, you actually talk a little bit more in some detail about Feng Menglong's notion of humor, like the way he treats humor, the way he thinks about humor, and its connection to morality in various ways.
Right.
So in the intro, you suggest that Feng has a particular way of connecting jokes, humor, and morality in which he advocates. And you've already talked a little bit about this in your introduction, actually, to this interview. He advocates that people, in the words of the book, be true to their genuine feelings and moral conscience in both their mindset and their action. Mm-hmm. And you talk in particular in the intro about the value of something that we might translate as youthful fancy, right? And its connection to humor here. So can you talk a little bit about that for us, for you? What's interesting for us to understand about this idea of youthful fancy and humor and the kind of morality that Feng Menglong is thinking about and promoting here?
Okay, yes. The Treasury of Laughs is actually the third of a series of three volumes that Feng Menglong edited. Collectively, they are called Tong Chi. And in my first book, I translated Tong Chi as Child's Folly. And that is a pretty conventional translation. I think I borrowed the term from some of my predecessors who had done research on Feng Menglong. But then I became a bit unhappy about this translation. Yes, Tong is, but Tong Chi, if I translate Tong Chi as Child's Folly, then people will say, oh, this is children's literature, but apparently these are not children's literature.
Yeah, not so much.
It's appropriate for children to read. And folly also has negative connotations, sort of, oh, these are human follies, and we should try to get rid of any emotions that is expressed in this trio. Now, Tong Chi has three volumes. The first one is Gua Zhi Er, Hanging Twigs. And so it's popular songs, usually love songs in the cities. So that's Gua Zhi Er, Hanging Twigs. And the second volume is Shan Ge, Hill Songs or Mountain Songs. And so these are folk songs sung by workers in the mountains and on the hills. And the third one is Xiao Fu, Treasury of Laughs. And so I noticed that in Hanging Twigs and Hill Songs, Feng Menglong is praising those singers, express their emotions in a very spontaneous way. And so men and women sing about their love, and sometimes the love is sort of forbidden love, the love that is not approved by the society, the love that is not approved by the parents. So young men and young women fell in love, and they talk about how they are affected to each other in their songs. So these seems to be more positive examples of how people bravely sing about their passions and they show disregard for social expectations or for social norms. But in the Treasury of Laughs, it's the opposite. It's sort of people are doing foolish things or say foolish things, not because they have passion, but because they suppress their passions or suppress their emotions and they suppress their spontaneity. And so they would do things that are very hypocritical or do things that are very calculating. And so there's a lot of jokes about people who are stingy, people who are chauvinistic, people who are overbearing, and people who, you know, show a lot of false pride. Mm-hmm. And so these are sort of negative examples of how human emotions are suppressed and then maybe twisted. And so Feng Long, in his preface to Xiaofu or Treasury of Love, say that he wants to use the jokes to sort of stimulate people to think about their own way of suppressing their emotions just to appear to be think twice about their behavior, and maybe they can then realize that they don't always have to suppress their feelings, that they can actually be more spontaneous and more truthful to their feelings. And Feng Long says that the society is sick because people always suppress their own feelings. And so it's almost like a collective mental illness. Everybody is trying to be different. And so this seems to be the underlying moral lessons that Feng Long tried to teach by telling jokes.
Now, in his preface, he also invokes a figure of a medieval trickster priest, right? This is the cloth sack monk. He says, right. Cloth sack monk, you're my master, you're my master. Now, you talk about this figure of the cloth sack monk in the introduction as well, and it seems like that might be a good place to go to now, since you just talked about these virtues and the values he's placing on these sorts of things in the preface. And he also invokes the cloth sack monk as his master in the preface. So can you talk about this cloth sack monk? What is he doing here and what's his importance?
Okay. The cloth sack monk claimed that he was a reincarnation of the Buddha Maitreya, Milafo. And you know, usually when we think about Milafo or Buddha Maitreya, we think about the laughing Buddha. And when I did research on the cloth sack monk, I realized that before this person was born in China, when the Chinese painters painted the portrait of Buddha Maitreya or Milafo, the picture of this Buddha is just very similar to other Buddhas, you know, compassionate, mildly smiling, but in general pretty serious and in good shape. But after the classic monk claimed that he was the reincarnation of Buddha Maitreya, the Chinese Buddhist painters started to alter the image of Milafo or Buddha Maitreya, and Milafo becomes a laughing Buddha with very round belly, you know, fat, and had a cloth sack on his shoulders. And so I started to do a little bit of research on cloth sack monk, and I found that when we think about the laughing Buddha, at least the laughing Buddha seems to be pretty good looking, but the historical cloth sack monk is portrayed to be somebody who is ugly, who looks like a bad guy. So people were sort of put off by him, and he was also filthy. He did not take a bath. He was smelly, and he was, you know, talking nonsense. He seems to be a crazy guy. And in his cloth sack, he stored a lot of food refuse, garbage. Sometimes he would distribute the food refuse or the garbage to the kids who seemed to be attracted to him. And so the adults thought of him as somebody who was crazy and filthy, but young children seems to be attracted to him. But this guy was always talking nonsense that nobody seems to take him seriously. But then before he was dying, he revealed himself to be, the reincarnation of Buddha Maitreya. And then after his passing, there was a lot of miracles around the place where he was buried. And then sometimes there would be sighting of him with his cloth sack. And then people started to think back on all the nonsense that he talked during his lifetime and realized that even though they sounded crazy, they all came true later. And so this is somebody who is always joking and who looks very unserious, who is even filthy, who is sort of disgusting. But the nonsense that he talked turned out not to be nonsense. And so I think when Feng Menglong evoked the image of classic monk, he was asking his audience not to take the jokes as simply jokes and that they should take the jokes seriously. And even though he sometimes has jokes that seems to be filthy and dirty, they are not so filthy and dirty. When you think about it, they actually are clean. I think it's a very interesting claim that there should be non-duality between what looks filthy and what inside is actually quite sacred. So I think that the treasury of laughs not only is entertaining, it also has some sort of philosophical undertone to it. And that is, you shouldn't take things at face value.
Great. Thank you so much. Yes. So after the preface, the book is actually divided into 13 sections.
Right.
These are sections that cohere around particular themes, and they range from age-old envy, rotten scholars, the untouchables, occultism and medicine, various vocations, extraordinary faculties, petty sport, mocking vulgarity is the eighth section. And then we move in the ninth section to air of sexually sophisticated women, body parts, funny mistakes, daily necessities, and finally intercalary words. So let's maybe, you've already generously read to us a couple of jokes. Now that listeners have a sense of, okay, there's this preface, the kind of virtues celebrated in the work, the sections into which the jokes are divided, would you mind reading a couple more for us of jokes that you find particularly interesting or particularly then jokes that you just like to read for us that come from any of those sections?
Okay, sure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Let me see. Okay, there is a joke. King Yama searching for an eminent doctor. King Yama, of course, is king in hell. So Yama, the king of hell, dispatches his runners to search for an eminent doctor in the world of the living with the instruction: if you find a physician whose clinic is not haunted by unrequited ghosts, he is the one I'm looking for. Now, every clinic the runners visit is crowded with unrequited ghosts of patients who died. But finally, they come to a clinic with only one single ghost lingering about. They decide that this physician must be an eminent one until, that is, they learned that the doctor just hung out his shingle yesterday. So this is a joke about physicians who kill patients. And we know that medicine was not a field that a lot of people seem to have faith in, because people think that a doctor would probably not want to cure you once and for all, because then he would not have further business to do with you. And so probably he would try to give you a slow solution so that you would have to come back to him time and again so that he can earn more money from you. And sometimes physicians are believed to be people who don't really have the skill, but pretend that they have the skill. And so there's a lot of wrongful diagnosis and things like that. And I think even in the modern days, from time to time, we see this kind of tragedies. And so I think the joke about a bad doctor may be universal.
Okay. And for listeners who are looking for this particular joke, who get their hands on a copy of the book, this is in the fourth chapter, Occultism and Medicine, and it's on page 116. Great.
Do we have time for another?
Yes, please. It would be great. Give us another one if you would be so generous.
Okay, page 149. Mm-hmm. The joke is shoe repairman. Mm-hmm. A shoe repairman has used only one pair of leather bottoms throughout his career. He always glues the leather bottoms to the shoe so superficially that after the customer leaves his shop, the bottoms will drop for sure. Trailing the customer, he would retrieve his leather as his principal. One day after following a customer for a distance, he fails to find his leather. Lamenting and crying over his permanent loss, he returns to the shop and is delighted to see that the leather had already been dropped, even before the customer stepped outside. And when I first read the joke, I couldn't help but actually be sympathetic with this shoe repairman, because he loves his leather bottom so much he can't bear to sort of part with it.
So, Beijing, like, these are, even now, these are, I think, they translate really well. They're really funny jokes. And I think sitting down to translate this particular kind of work poses different kinds of challenges, right, and different kinds of difficulties than perhaps translating another kind of work. Can you talk a little bit for us about what, for you, were some of the challenges of translating this particular work? What was particularly challenging? What was particularly difficult? And can you take us into your process a little bit?
Okay, yes. Feng Long was a man from Suzhou, and so sometimes he would include Suzhou dialect and Suzhou slangs in his jokes. And because I am from Taiwan, I cannot speak the Suzhou dialect, and I don't really have the vocabulary in my quote-unquote encyclopedia about those slangs. Sometimes it's difficult for me to understand the Suzhou slangs and the Suzhou puns, etc. But Feng Long somehow anticipated that. So sometimes he would have sort of an editor's note saying that this word in the Suzhou dialect is pronounced like that in Mandarin Chinese. And so if you speak Mandarin Chinese, you may not get it, but you know, and so he would give us the note to help us understand the Suzhou puns a little better. But he doesn't always do that. And so sometimes when I encounter something that is a Suzhou dialect or a Suzhou slang, I feel that maybe I won't be able to really get it, and I have to guess it a lot. And also there's a lot of puns in the jokes. And so sometimes two Chinese words have very similar or the same pronunciations, but they mean totally different things. And other times it's two Chinese characters that look very similar to each other, but they mean totally different things. And so when you read the jokes, you can appreciate it if you know the Chinese language. But for people who are not a native speaker of Chinese, those puns could be difficult to understand, and a lot of explanations in my footnotes. And when the footnotes are long, the jokes become not so funny. And so my difficulty is, how can I translate something that is difficult for non-native speakers, but still convey some sort of humor in it? And oftentimes I have to say, I give up. I'll just say, read my notes and you would understand why it is funny for the Chinese, but maybe not for you, but you know, I'm sorry. And other times, he would use some literary allusions that are not very popular. And so I have to admit that there are some phrases that I just couldn't find in any dictionary. And so again, I have to do a lot of guesswork. And sometimes he would mention a certain toy or a certain musical instrument that I'm not familiar with. But under those circumstances, I actually find Google pretty useful. I would type in the Chinese characters for that particular toy or particular musical instrument, and Google actually shows me how it looks like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm a total believer in Google as a research tool. I'm completely with you there.
Yes, yes. But sometimes there are things that even Google cannot understand. And so I would really have to resort to just guessing games. And other times it's not that the phrases or the material things that puzzle me. It's sort of, you understand every single word, but you still cannot understand the joke. Probably because the comedian's brain works differently from my brain. And so I just cannot understand it. And I will read it and read it and read it. And still, I have to say, oh, I give up, skip. And then I go to the next one. But I keep that joke in my mind. And sometimes when I was watching a PBS murder mystery or reading a Chinese or Japanese murder mystery, it hits me and I said, oh, I got it. It's not that the joke book has a lot of murders and mysteries. It's just that I think, you know, murder mysteries and solving the puzzles and understanding the jokes sometimes work in very similar ways. So when a mystery is solved on TV or in a detective book, it inspires me to think, oh, maybe I should alter my logical thinking. And then I can understand the joke better because the joke, I think that the comedians is always teasing us. And he says, okay, when you are hearing the joke, your mind works this way and you make your own logical associations. But the punchline tells you that your logic is way off. And so you feel cheated, but then you have to smile and say, okay, I have to admit that the comedian is smarter than I am because he thinks this way and it seems to be illogical, but after all, he simply follows a different logic. So the joke is logical. It's not the common sense kind of logic.
I love that. And I love how you're kind of inviting us to think about murder mysteries and sort of solving problems and coming up with solutions in a way that puts it into conversation with jokes. I think that's really fabulous. So, Bijing, is it too much for me to ask you to share another couple of jokes with us? Before we wrap up, because we're moving toward, if you can believe it, we're already moving toward the time where we'll have to wrap up. But there's so many wonderful, delicious jokes in this book. And it would be such a shame if we didn't at least share with listeners maybe just a couple more of the ones that you think.
Thank you for giving me that. On page 162, there is a joke about forgetfulness. And I think any joke about forgetfulness is funny because sometimes we forget things and we have to laugh at ourselves. A man brings a hatchet to the bamboo grove to cut bamboo. Having a sudden urge, he puts the hatchet on the ground and enters the bamboo grove to go. While he is relieving himself, he incidentally looks up and says, oh, we can use some bamboo at home. There is some nice bamboo here. Unfortunately, I didn't bring a hatchet. After he's done, he sees the hatchet and is overjoyed, saying, heaven has answered my request. There happens to be a hatchet here. As he is searching for the right bamboo to apply the hatchet, he spots the shit, gets vexed, and complains, who emptied his bowels all over the place? It almost hurted my feet. So this is somebody who just cannot remember anything that happened to him or that came across his mind just 1 second before. And of course, this is hilarious because it exaggerates things. However, I think everybody has some forgetful.
Absolutely.
I can probably appreciate this kind of joke.
Definitely.
Okay, there is another joke, a little off color.
That's okay. Let's go there.
That's page 248. Mm-hmm. Upset by children.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. Husband and wife are doing the bedroom thing. At the peak of her pleasure, the wife keeps crying out, "I'm dying." The two sons are both in bed with them. Hearing the mother's remark, the elder son cannot help but burst out laughing. The mother is embarrassed and angrily hits the boy on his head. The younger son voices his support of the mother, saying, "Mommy is right to strike big brother. Hearing that you are dying instead of crying, he laughs." So this tells you that you should not put your children on the bed. On your bed.
Lessons from Feng Long Long.
Right.
That's great. Thank you so much, Bijing. So we're now at the point where it's time for us to wrap up. But are there any other jokes that you are burning to share with us? We maybe have time at most for one more, but if there's one more that you're like burning to get on the air, we can definitely make time for that.
Okay. One more sex joke.
One more. Let's do one more sex joke for the listeners, for the people.
page 252.
Okay.
It's called Aching Belly. Mm-hmm. The wife about to give birth suffers a severe pain in her belly and keeps snapping at her husband, saying, "It's all your fault that I'm in such distress." The husband coaxes, "My dear, to save you from further complaints, after the baby is born, I'll castrate myself." The wife renews her scolding, "You stinky turtle. Just when I'm feeling a bit better, here you go again, getting me mad." And the joker's note: her scolding words should be spoken in a sick-like voice for it to be truly funny. And of course, this means the wife doesn't want to have the pain of delivering the baby, but she still wants sex.
That's right. Well, Bijing, I wish we could talk honestly for another hour with you just reading jokes. But we're at the time to wrap up. Now, there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't have time to talk about. There's all kinds of great stuff that listeners will find when they read the introduction to situate themselves within the world of the book and the world that emerges from the book. And there's also some just pages and pages and pages of fabulous jokes that you've very generously shared moments from, but that listeners will find an ample quantity when they find the book for themselves. Given that, though, is there anything else that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners before we wrap up?
I think we've actually covered the ground pretty well. Thank you very much for asking me those very interesting questions that allow me to talk about my book. And I hope that the interview would inspire our listeners to actually go out and buy a copy of my book.
Yay.
Thank you very much.
And now that the book is out, what's next for you? What are you currently thinking about and working on?
Okay, because I have been writing a lot of essays and then, you know, a couple of books about Feng Monglong, I felt that even though I really love this guy, I have to say goodbye to him at least for a moment. And so my next research project may be about Kok Xingga, Zheng Chenggong, and the history of Taiwan, because I am from Taiwan and I feel that I have been doing research on Chinese culture and society, and perhaps it is time for me to think about where I am from. And I choose Kok Xingga to be sort of my first project in the history of Taiwan, because Kok Xingga is both somebody who is interesting, who is important for the history of Taiwan, and also he was an important person in Ming history. And so I feel that I don't need to depart from Ming history, and still I can do something that is very different from what I have been doing so far.
Great. Well, best of luck with that work. And thanks for taking time away from that.
Thank you very much.
With us and share some jokes with us today. It's been a pleasure. And thank you so much.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us today. And we'll catch you next time.